welcome to episode 101 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray, recorded on the 27th of September, India time. I am Vikram Mohan. Also from Fourspire Podcasts, the latest binge on has four rib-tickling Hindi comedy movies from Raj and me, and or is it Raj and I? And for news from the tech world, including the latest on Xbox pricing, PlayStation pricing, and more, listen to What's Up Geeks. Head over to fourspire.net. That's the number four, spire, S-P-I-R-E.net, to listen and subscribe. All right, let's bring your host in now. Hey, Arnab, how are you?
Hi, Vikram. How are you doing?
Good. Surviving yet another week in this year, which is, I guess that's an accomplishment.
All right. So let's start off today.
I mean, personally, with SPB's demise, I think especially for South Indians, that's been a really big loss for us. So just listening.
So how big is SPB in terms of, let's say, Ilaiyaraja or Air Rahman?
I think for many of us, I'm sure they would agree and or also staunchly disagree. SPB and Ilaiyaraja are kind of like two sides of the same coin, because most of everyone's favorite Ilaiyaraja songs have been sung by SPB. Okay. And vice versa, I mean, your favorite SPB songs, he hasn't done too much for Rahman, because Rahman tended to use a lot of singers. Whereas with Ilaiyaraja, it was given that, especially if it was a big ticket hero, if it was Rajini or Kamal, it will invariably be SPB singing. So I think they were two sides of the same coin. And there is this very heartbreaking video of Ilaiyaraja just talking about his death. And there's a 40-second silence or 20-second silence in between, where I'm sure anyone who's a fan would just break down. Anyway, I don't think I would want to talk more about this. Let's move on.
Okay. So the first thing, so today we're going to be talking about the Farmers Bill. I'm talking about the Farmers Bill because the other Arnab Goswami won't. So one Arnab has to take the slack, of course. So that's why I'll be talking about it. But before I start, I mean, I was going to start off by talking about the Farmers Bill. But before this insane craziness came up with Anushka Sharma, you know, having that statement about Sunil Gavaskar. And I thought that I should say something about this. So for those of you who have not heard of this craziness, so Sunil Gavaskar, after Virat Kohli dropped KL Rahul twice of successive deliveries, pretty easy catches. And then, of course, his batting has been disastrous. And one reason for that, obviously, that Gavaskar doesn't know is that I've been taking him in my fantasy team and making him the captain. That's one reason that he doesn't know. But during commentary, he said that Virat Kohli should have played better bowling than, Anushka Sharma, who, and that immediately created outrage across the net that he's again dragging in Anushka Sharma for Virat Kohli's failures. And some people even said that this was sexual innuendo that he was making, essentially. Now, the fact is, and of course, nobody cares about the fact, and Anushka Sharma's outrage and statement of outrage didn't also refer to the fact that what he was referring to specifically was a video that Virat Kohli and Anushka Sharma themselves posted of them playing cricket on the terrace with Anushka Sharma bowling.
Yes.
during COVID-19. And so what Sunil Gavaskar was saying, he wasn't saying anything about or to Anushka Sharma at all. What he was saying was that Virat Kohli should have played a higher standard of bowling, in the sense that he looks clearly unprepared. And I'm going to say that Sunil Gavaskar, having played this game for so many years, is smart enough to figure out, based on the way somebody is playing, whether he is, let's say, he has done his riyaz or he's kind of coming in cold. So that was exactly what he said. It had nothing to do with Anushka Sharma, in the same way that when Jeff Boycott used to say that even my mom could hit this for a six.
Right.
He wasn't being sexist to his mom. Okay. Nobody at that point of time had, had any kind of outrage on that. Because it was a way of saying that this is really terrible bowling or this is really terrible batting. And so he used to use that as an example. So this was precisely what Sunil Gavaskar did. And there is, and for those of you who may not be aware of this, this is something which is very common to cricketers, especially Indian batsmen who think, it's not just Indian batsmen, by the way. So Patrick Patterson, I don't know if you've ever read this interview. So Patrick Patterson, for those of you who don't follow the game of cricket as closely as I do, especially in the 90s, was a West Indian fast bowler, very fast. And he didn't play for long, but when he played, he was pretty fearsome. Once during an England tour, he basically broke Gatting's nose. And I read this book on that too, about that tour, that when the ball was, when they recovered the ball, there were little pieces of bone stuck within the seam. So he was that, yeah. So he didn't play for long. And so one of the things that there was, this is a beautiful interview of Patrick Patterson, which somebody actually found him out and did this interview because it kind of vanished. He had some, he had some psychological issues and stuff. As he said, he's forgotten many things. And one of the things which he said was very interesting was that one of the reasons he thinks that he never played much was that when he was bowling at the nets to Vivian Richards, he kept on, Vivian Richards was unable to play him. And so Vivian Richards basically made sure, as he said, that Vivian Richards didn't like that. He didn't like the fact that during nets, he was basically not being able to be Vivian Richards when this guy was bowling. And so this is for those of us who have some contact and talk to people, you know, informally, who are kind of around players. This is something which is very common, actually, that, big stars, when they feel they're out of form, or when they're not at their best, they basically want people not to go full tilt at them during the nets. One reason could be because it's a confidence thing, that they believe that, look, we are great players and there's nobody's doubting Virat Kohli's greatness. But what I don't want is, if let's say a bowler comes and bowls full tilt at me and I am not being able to kind of middle the ball, that I would not be confident before going out to bat. So, you know, give me slow donkey drops that I can play. So that's really what Gavaskar was alluding to. He felt that he just hadn't faced the kind of bowling, and he just didn't have the kind of preparation that's needed in a marquee tournament like the IPL. And this is not just a criticism of Virat Kohli. If you have been watching the games, as I have been, there are many players there who are physically out of shape. And they also aren't mentally, I would say, there still. One of the reasons could be because there is no crowd, but I also think that they just haven't played competitive cricket. And those players who have come off playing competitive cricket, just look, for instance, all the England players, they generally look good. The Australian players generally look good. And the Indian players who haven't played for a long time, most of them look very rusty, unless, of course, you are the second rung of players. You know, the Mayank Agarwals of the world, who I'm pretty sure over the last few months have been practicing like hell because they want to take that next step. I mean, Mayank Agarwal, for instance, is in the test side, but still he's not, if he wants to go to an A-plus grade contract. So that's what he's struggling for. And those people were like this straight off the bat. KL Rahul was flowing straight off the bat. Now, Rohit Sharma wasn't flowing, but then he had the good fortune of playing KKR. So that's a privilege that Virat Kohli yet hasn't had. So that was all that Gavaskar was talking about. And this just goes to show what a concerted social media campaign can do, which totally, totally changes the truth of what Gavaskar said, in what context, and made it out as if he had made a sexual innuendo, which was, I heard the commentary, and there was absolutely nothing. There was absolutely nothing. May I have your attention, please? If there's anything that I know is about sexual innuendo. So there was virtually nothing in what Gavaskar said. And what he said was sound. It was well within his remit as a commentator to make that comment, that Virat Kohli just should have played a better standard of bowling than what he's played. Now, should he have mentioned Anushka Sharma? Well, he was trying to make a humorous point, and he was making the humorous point because they themselves had put out this video.
Exactly.
It wasn't some privileged information that he was divulging. It was just based on a video that they had themselves put out. The reason why I want to get to the farm bill is for various reasons. One reason is that there is a canard which is going around right now, which says that the reason why the farm bill is not being is discussed in the national media because it's an embarrassment to the BJP government. It's a terrible thing. It's a draconian measure. And so when I first heard this, my first tendency was to believe, yeah, that perhaps might be the case. I mean, there must be one reason why debate number two, debate number three, and all of these debates centered around Sushant Singh and Deepika Padukone for weeks on end. What is going on? I mean, this is significant news. Why aren't the, let's say, BJP-leaning channels covering this? Of course, NDTV is covering for this. But why aren't... what I did was, first, I wanted to listen to what the most trenchant critics of the government would have to say about this bill. So I first did a little bit of study as to what the bill was. It's not that I understood a lot of it because I'm not a policy guy. This is really not something which I honestly am very interested in. But I still did a little bit of, you know, reading around. And then I said, okay, let me listen to who would perhaps give the best critique of this farm bill. So I decided to listen to P. Sainath, who happens to be, you know, a kind of a doyen of agricultural reporting in India. He's very famous. He's a Magsaysay Award winner. Everybody Loves a Good Rot is a classic. I've read it. It's a very up-close and personal reportage of the plight of small farmers in India and how bad policy and bad government affects their lives. It's a brilliant book which I encourage you to read. It's a collection of articles that he wrote for, I believe, Times of India. I'm not 100% sure. At one point of time, it's just a collection of his articles. But I thought that he has a good writing style, and I thought that he would perhaps present the most cogent, well-argued, he's an expert, I guess. Whatever his argument was, I assumed would be the argument that everybody would then use against the government. And I was shocked. I literally was shocked because I heard him talk on Faye D'Souza. I heard him talk on Rajdeep Sardesai. I heard him talk on News Click. And in each of them, he was absolutely incoherent. He couldn't explain what was so dastardly about this bill, except the standard bromides against big business, you know, capitalist evil. I mean, other than leaving aside EPW word cloud items, there was absolutely no substance in his critique, which led me to wonder, could it be that there's nothing to critique about these bills? That these are absolutely anodyne bills that are being passed? So then I did some more reading. And here's what I came up with. Here's what I believe is going on. So for those of you who haven't been following this story, and I totally get why you haven't been following the story, because this is nowhere as exciting as whether Shraddha Kapoor took CBD oil. But since you're listening to this podcast, I'm guessing, and you're still listening to the podcast, I'm guessing you have some interest in learning what's going on. So the government has passed three bills, which are collectively called the farm bills, because each of these bills are quite a mouthful, and I've written them down because obviously I would remember them. So one is the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Promotion and Facilitation Bill 2020. I don't know why they have names like this. And then this is the first bill, and then there's the Farmers Empowerment and Protection Agreement on Price Assurance and Farm Services. So this is bill number two. And then there's the bill number three, which I will deal with right away, is an amendment to the Essential Commodities Act, I think.
So what this does, so let's deal with the simplest one at the beginning. It basically removes limitations on hoarding. So the government has specific food items, specific agricultural items that have had anti-hoarding measures on them, which means that you cannot stockpile more than a certain amount of it. So what the government has done, it has weakened that to the extent that you can basically store as much stuff as you want of things in that list, unless it is an emergency. So unless it's an emergency, which possibly means that, you know, it's going to be very extreme conditions like war or something like that, in which the government might impose. But in general, it has removed the limitations on hoarding. Now, this has a history. So the famine of 1942 was basically caused, one of the reasons why it was caused, I mean, of course, it was caused by the British, because they basically took our grains and gave it to their soldiers because they thought that, you know, Bengalis dying, we were subhumans. This was directly what Churchill said. So, you know, but one of the reasons was that there was hoarding. So people brought up food grains as an investment article to sell when the prices went high. And of course, this whole thing about hoarding obviously pushes the prices up. So it's a non-virtuous loop. So Nehru, at one point of time, when he was a prime minister, had asked for hoarders to be hanged from trees. Now imagine if Narendra Modi had said this about anybody else, this would be the ultimate fascist thing to say. But of course, since Chachaji said it, it was perfectly okay, because, you know, Chachaji loves kids. So this thing was, you know, is a legacy of those times when India genuinely did not produce enough food to feed itself. That is no longer true. It's actually the other way around. So what this has done, this is what exactly happens with government regulation, is that those who are going to hoard are in any case going to hoard. Okay. That is going to happen. What hoarding bills do is that it prevents legitimate businesses from being able to stockpile agricultural produce legitimately. Because, you know, a Walmart is not going to, by policy, is not going to do something that violates the Essential Commodities Act. So all that this does is it keeps out. And this is the reason why these things have been kept in. Actually, I mean, people aren't stupid. These things have been kept in so that the evil capitalists, big businesses, cannot do the things that they require to be done in order to start their businesses, which is to be able to stockpile at a single place amounts of agricultural produce that they need. You can do it now. So that's one of the reasons the Essential Commodities Act has been changed. Again, I don't think that any of the farmers' unrest is because of this. So this is incidental, but it comes along with the pie. So number three bill we've already dealt with. Now let's deal with the most contentious aspect, which is the first bill, which is the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Promotion and Facilitation Bill 2020. So what this bill does is that for so long, it has been mandated that if you are a restaurant owner or you want to have a food business or you want to be the next Walmart, you cannot go and buy direct from farmers. You have to go through an intermediary. And these are known as Agricultural Produce Market Committees, or APMCs, which is basically a clique or a coterie.
This is basically the mandi, right?
Yes, it's a mandi. It is a clique, a coterie. It's a labyrinthine system. It's not a simple system. It's an extremely labyrinthine legacy of the time when we believed that the nation was basically held together by red tape. So this reform should have happened in the 1990s, but we'll come to why it didn't happen in the 1990s. So what this does is it basically says, it does not remove anything. It only adds choice. It says that if you want to buy from the farmers, you can directly go to them. You don't have to go through APMCs. That's it. That's all that it says. So it allows farmers to sell to big agriculture. So it allows them to sell to Walmart or to Reliance or whoever comes into that business, and to restaurants. It allows them to sell directly.
Okay, just hold on a second. So what I want to understand is, right now, let's say Big Basket, which is one of the biggest grocery chains in India, I mean, on online grocery chains, they don't procure from the farmers. Currently, they procure it from the mandi.
Yes.
And now the farmer can sell directly to Big Basket instead of going to a mandi and the mandi selling it to Big Basket or Reliance.
Exactly.
Okay.
So obviously, because there are middlemen who provide no value, there's obviously a markup, a massive markup for the middlemen. And on top of that, there is tax which is collected. There's mandi tax. Apparently, there is a law which says you can't collect mandi tax from the farmers. But obviously, the prices are adjusted so the farmers ultimately end up paying for the mandi tax. So at the very brief, if there's nothing else you want to understand about this, this is all that the bill does. It doesn't remove anything. It allows people to directly sell. And you would think, why is this a big deal in this day and age? Isn't this the way commerce works? I mean, how can the state mandate that you have to buy things in a certain way? And that's really what socialism has always been in this country. This is the system that the NDTVs, the Wires, and all of these people, they want this system to survive because of their own vested interest in a socialist system. So this doesn't make any sense, but it still survived. And what this government is trying to do is it's trying to do something which seems to be just plain and simple common sense. The second thing, which is what the second bill does, is that it allows for contract farming, that it again allows agricultural businesses, let's just call them agribusinesses, Big Baskets, whoever wants to step into this business, let's say PepsiCo, whoever deals with a lot of agricultural produce, they can now have direct contracts with farmers. So that farmers are guaranteed a certain price that they will get. So this is again, linked with the agriculture futures market. So if you want to buy, if I'm a guy who's betting, if things are rupees 100 unit, I'll say, okay, I'm expecting that it'll go up to 200 rupees. So I will enter into a contract that with the farmers that you will supply this to me at 150. So this allows that kind of futures-based that kind of investment. And it also allows, from a farmer's perspective, the assurance that they will get a fixed rate for whatever they're producing.
Now, this system, what you're mentioning, Arnav, I mean, what will be new, this has already been running successfully in the poultry industry, right? I mean, even in India.
First of all, there are states like Bihar where APMCs have been gotten rid of for years.
Okay.
And I'll come to that. This is nothing revolutionary at all. Absolutely nothing. But in order to understand the outrage, you have to ask this next question, which, who basically benefits from this system? Well, one thing that I haven't mentioned here is that the government, and this is the core contentious issue, is the government provides something called a minimum support price, which is the government guarantees that, okay, dude, no matter what happens, I'm going to buy these things. There are certain agricultural produce which come on this list. I'm going to pay this amount of money regardless. If you can't sell it to the market, if the market is too tough, we will buy it. This is called the minimum support price. Okay. So the core conflict is coming from the fact that farmers think that the minimum support price is going to go away. Now, the first thing about minimum support price, this is the lie that is being vended so-and-so, that the minimum support price, what will happen to poor farmers? The thing is, poor farmers don't benefit from minimum support price. Minimum support price, if you look at the data, overwhelmingly benefits large and medium farmers, mostly large farmers. So these are the guys who are super, super rich. Okay, these are the guys who own like Havelis, and these guys are rich people, also don't pay tax. So the people who are actually agitating are rich farmers. If you note where the agitation is happening, it's happening in Punjab and Haryana, where they're the richest farmers. So the first lie that you're being sold is that this is starving farmers, farmer suicide. What is going to happen to farmers? No, the small farmers, as a matter of fact, you'll be surprised. And I was surprised to read that when MSP increases, the price of food increases. And that is actually detrimental to small farmers. Because believe it or not, small farmers in this country don't actually produce. They are net consumers. So they essentially consume more than they produce. And why does that happen? That happens because of the fragmented nature of land. And because the fact that agriculture, given the agricultural units that most small farmers own, is just not commercially viable. It's like if you have a garden at the back of your house and you come in after office and produce, go and potter around in the plants. And then one day decide to quit your day job and do that for a living in your backyard. What do you think is going to happen to you? So that's really what happens to small farmers, is the small farmers just cannot produce the amount of crop that's needed to break even because they don't have the economy of scale. So what happens is they get into the spirals of debt. So for this year, in order to cover themselves, they get loans from the local money lenders. Because of that, everything they produce next year at the farm gate is taken away by the local money lenders. So at that point of time, what is the guy going to do? He's going to go to the store and buy the grain he himself grew. So guess who MSP increase actually benefits? It's not the small farmers at all. So this is the lie that you're being sold. So when they talk about media selling you the lie by covering Deepika Padukone, no, it's the other thing that's being sold. The fact that MSP increase is actually detrimental to small farmers. And none of these things, none of what we're going to be talking about in this podcast, in these bills, actually solve the problem of small farmers. So that is a valid criticism to make. That this has got nothing to do with small farmers. This will not solve farmer suicides. This will not do anything to them. The solution is in a totally different space. But the main thing that you should carry is that the people who are protesting are rich farmers. They're not small farmers, which is why, again, there's very minimal protests in Bengal, for instance, other than what Trinamool Congress will obviously trigger. But from an organic point of view, this doesn't affect farmers in Bengal because most of them are small farmers. Small farmers living very close to the poverty line. This is for large and medium farmers, mostly large farmers. So if you look at, again, I'll say that if you look at the MSP protests, they're basically large farmers who have always been, they've been guaranteed a considerably high price. Now, again, they're businessmen, right? If you are a businessman and somebody is guaranteeing that they will buy something from you that will guarantee you a profit, that's a big deal. And their main fear is that is going away. Even though the Prime Minister has said that it's not going away, I will also take that with a little bit of salt. I think they might have good reasons to think it's going away, because I would think it is, actually. So, because I think this is step one. I'll come to that, whether and how soon it will go away. But this is the first step to make sure that the MSP goes away. So MSP is not just a federally mandated price. On top of that, and in India, it's called bonus, different states put a bonus on the MSP for different kinds of crops. So in some states, there's a sugar on top that you will get, and with the state ponies up. And of course, given that this is a socialist system, there is no reason why some crops get that and some crops don't. And the reason why some crops get this little sugar on top and the others don't, if you really look into it, it's because of maybe the politician who fixed it is in that business, or his nephew is, or he's getting money from the people who are. So that's really the way it has worked. So this is a labyrinthine system, absolutely non-transparent system of who gets these extra sugar and tops from a state level. So because of this, these are the two reasons why you realize that there are vested interests which want the current system to go on. The third thing is that these mandis that we're talking about, the APMCs, guess who runs them? Who are the people who run these things? Large farmers. So large farmers, I mean, if you have a farm and you have like, four sons, one of them will go into the agri business. They will become these middlemen. So the reason why the Shiromani Akali Dal has withdrawn is that their entire political party is basically these middlemen in Punjab. And they are reading the writing on the wall. Again, the prime minister is saying, we're not touching the APMCs. I mean, they can go on. Why are you guys getting so worked up? You know, it's not like Sunil Gavaskar said anything about you. But the reason is that these people have realized, very much so, that they have realized that this is a step towards moving away from MSP. And not only that, why would anybody go through the APMC if they can deal directly with farmers? Why would they go through a middleman and take the markup? Why would they? They won't, right? So the market will ultimately destroy the APMC. The government won't have to do it. The market will. And the last thing is that the people who benefit from the system are the states, because there is a state, the state takes some cut from the mandi tax. So states lose revenue. If, again, Modi will say, there's nothing is changing. But of course it will change. Of course, APMCs will gradually, not fast, will hopefully die. So it's states which are losing revenue. This is why Trinamool Congress and these people, they are so worried about it. That whenever they look at things, the first thing they look at is, will we lose revenue? Oh yes, attack, fascist attack on us. So that is why you will find many other states which otherwise have really nothing in this game, suddenly getting so worked up about this. So, is the new system good overall? Well, first let's look at agricultural reforms. The fact is, in 1991, we had reforms of our licensing system for industry. In those times, in the 80s, you needed government permits to expand your factory, to increase production, to decrease production, to change what you are going to produce in your plants. You needed a Babu to sign off on every goddamn thing you did, which again led to delays, led to corruption, led to bribery. And that these things were designed precisely for that. This was exactly the way the Congress Party has lived, has subsisted in this country for so many years, is through this system. This system of socialism was to help them. And no matter what the Ramchandra goes, these are the things which, you know, fan fiction, Congress fan fiction writers like Ram Guha won't even cover. But this is the reason why it has existed for so long. Now, in 1991, when Dr. Manmohan Singh, and more than that, P.V. Narasimha Rao came in, who wanted to dismantle this Gandhi family way of basically bleeding the nation. It's him he took. Again, he was Congress Party, but we know he wasn't really a Congress Party. He was somebody inside the Congress Party trying to change it from inside to, you know, make it something which would be a much better party, I would say. Of course, he didn't succeed, but that didn't mean that he heroically didn't try. So when he and Dr. Manmohan Singh, they tried to shift, and they were very successful in shifting India away from the tentacles of the Gandhi family license raj, which started with Nehru, continued with Indira Gandhi, and persisted with Rajiv Gandhi, and which is what the Rahul Gandhis of the world want to return to ultimately. Of course, it will be, you know, BuzzFeedized and sufficiently made scoop-whooped for the current generation, but it'll ultimately be the same thing. So what, and the BJP also, once they have taken power, hasn't been very different, because ultimately in this country, we don't really have an economic right. We have a political right, we have a religious right, but pretty much everybody, I mean, the RSS has a trade union which it runs. Okay, some majdoor something, which is run by the RSS. So obviously, you know, when you run a trade union, you know, we can see where you're coming from. So it's not just a criticism of the Congress, it's also a criticism of the BJP, but the fact is that the Congress guys, they made it. It's their little palace. So agricultural reforms, by the way, didn't even happen in 1991 because no party in India has the courage, the cojones, to touch large farmers. They don't have the political will. And we're talking about huge farmers. These are uber capitalists. Okay, they're exploitative. They have armies. They have private armies. So if in your mind you're thinking of the starving farmer who's committing suicide because they're caught in a debt trap, this is the biggest trick that these guys played, is that when you think about farmers, you think about these guys. But actually the people who prevent reforms, I mean, the people who cannot, don't have money to have food, they aren't powerful players in the political system, as anybody with an iota of common sense would deduce. So it's not them. They are not the persons who have prevented any kind of reforms in the agricultural sectors. It's the Chautalas of the world. It's the Chautalas of the world, the Bhajan Lals, the Bansi Lals in Haryana, and the big, big power players in Punjab, who have prevented this from happening. And these people are, as I said, uber capitalists. So there's nobody in their right mind should be shedding tears for these people. So agricultural reforms haven't happened because of the massive, massive might these people have had and their ability to mobilize crowds like they have done so far. So if you touch them, you're going to lose votes. We're going to bring things out. We're going to bring people out, and we're going to make life tough for you. This is essentially trade unionism without the trade and without the unionism. So the only people who support these are the EPW crowd. Because again, they have this bait and switch. So they work for the interests of these big farmers, but in order to get public sympathy, in order to get the moral high ground, they show these picture of these poor peasants. And we are talking about these poor peasants as if the conflict is between these poor peasants and the evil Walmarts of the world. You know, this is a very easy thing for people to understand. This is like an Arnab Goswami kind of narrative. Okay, so these people will shit on Arnab Goswami for his simplistic presentation of news, but they do the exact same thing. And that's exactly what P. Sainath was doing. He was being no different from Arnab Goswami, except there was not this feverish, you know, moving of hands and sudden modulations of voice. So minus that, it was essentially the same kind of rhetoric. There was an enemy, and we have the moral high ground. And the rest of them are all shit. There's no difference between them. Now, the second thing is the new system good? Well, technically, the system doesn't take anything away. It just increases choice. And anybody in their right mind should say, we stand for choice. Now, again, will the mandi system collapse? Maybe it will collapse. If the whole business model of direct consumer to seller even takes off. And this is not easy, and this is not going to be fast either. So it's not as if there will be a gazillion number of rich farmers who are going to be jobless tomorrow. No. The current situation, because of the inertia of motion, is going to go on for at least a generation, I would say. But what this does is ultimately it starts the reforms in the farming sector, which haven't happened in any shape or form at a federal level from 1991 in any significant way. Now, if somebody could say this, even this is not significant enough. And that's a valid criticism. But the fact that this is the bare minimum that should be done, and it is being done, which is a good thing. So what's the worst that can happen from this? The worst that can happen from this is that the middlemen class might have their influence and have their income reduced. But is anybody today grieving for travel agents? Have you ever remembered them? So if you haven't been sad for travel agents, I don't see why you should be sad for the people who ran the mandi. Now, again, let's come back to the MSP. How good is the MSP? So again, the Prime Minister has assured people that, you know, the MSP is not going away. And I don't think it's going to go away, if for nothing else, but because that would possibly be a very politically brave decision. And I don't think that this government will go that far. I think it will, I think the government, and this is exactly the way I would say that good governance works, is you don't push things too far. You do something, you let it die down, you let the attention go somewhere else, you wait for years, it's not months or days, and then you make your next move, and you do it in small increments. You kind of keep on whittling away at things. You know, you don't take a sledgehammer and just break the table. You just use a sandpaper and keep on, you know, brushing and rubbing against the legs of the table till one day it falls. That's how you change things. That's how you realistically change things in a place like India. You can't do things with revolution and with sweeping reforms. That needs to, I mean, you do it in 1991, we did it, but that was when we had a gun to our temple, really, because our nation was essentially bankrupt at that point of time. And so that's why we had to do it. There was no other way. But generally, that's not a good thing to do. So now one of the big problems with MSP is that the MSP also needs to be done away with. First of all, as I said, the MSP benefits large farmers. It doesn't benefit small farmers. As a matter of fact, with MSP, the prices are raised because if the government is giving you this price, it's simple supply and demand, that small farmers actually have to buy wheat and grain at higher prices because of MSP. So this is actually against small and poor farmers. Now, there's another problem with MSP, and this is exactly the classic thing of what happens when government interferes in free markets, is that MSP, if you take it together with the state incentives or the bonus, where you are incentivized to grow some crops but aren't incentivized to grow other crops, what happens is you have too much of one crop and too little of another crop. For instance, I read that pulses, for instance, suffer because they don't fall under that list. And rice and wheat, there is overproduction. So again, this is what happens when governments interfere in free markets in very non-transparent ways. So the algorithm is not known as to why some people get and some people don't get, especially at the state level. So this is, again, this system does ultimately is going to hopefully do away with that too. And the last thing is that the MSP leads to, because it's a guaranteed, the government is guaranteed to buy your goods to a certain extent, it leads to the government buying a shitload of stuff that is destroyed, rots in the granaries, and ultimately we, the taxpayers, have to pay money to dispose of it. So this is not just a question of the amount of money that we waste buying things we don't need. It's also the ginormous costs of storing that grain and then disposing of that grain. So these are the things that you will normally not list in, if you even have been paying attention. These are normally things which people don't, right, at least in mainstream media, talk about are the downsides of MSPs.
For example, Arnab, in Telangana, I believe I read a news which said that starting from the next sowing season, the government will give out a list of crops and only those would be procured, you mentioned the state bonus. So only those crops would be eligible for a bonus. So I think that's more of linking it to the market demand rather than saying that you grow whatever you want and, you know, we'll buy it. And like you said, probably it'll rot in godowns.
Yes. And reasons why crops get onto that list is because of mainly of corruption, because that the ministers or the politicians or their backers stand directly to gain because they are invested in those businesses. So those things get into the list and the others don't. And so again,
there's one more side to this too, quite often, I would be rightly accused of somebody, an urban guy sitting and talking about farming, but people are growing things which, you know, you can't afford to use that amount of water. So in arid regions, you know, you're having very water intensive crops.
Yes.
That also needs to be changed. And only the
in market. In Punjab, you're growing paddy.
Right.
Nobody has paddy. It's not Bengal. Okay. This is not a paddy growing region. There's no local demand for it. You're just growing, consuming groundwater just because you know that you're going to get this bonanza at the end. And that thing is going to rot. So that's really what MSP and what the current system has brought about. And the truth needs to be said.
So how is the misinformation being spread? Well, again, you know, P. Synods, you know, again, I come back to him because I wanted to hear what he had to say. And maybe there's something that I'm not seeing, honestly, that basically being a, you know, being a city dweller and being really having nothing to do with farming myself, maybe there's something which I am not understanding. That's it. Oh, so that's the thing that the government, the evil government, actually wants to do away. But he couldn't come up with one single thing. Not one single thing. In 3 or 4 interviews, if he missed it in one place, you know, Rajdeep Sardesai, he was there for 20 minutes. With Faye D'Souza, it was like more than an hour. And he could still not come to the point. So basically, all his points were that was that this is a continuation of the selling of the country that started with, you know, Manmohan Singh's reforms. You know, before that, obviously, according to P. Sainath, you know, things were great. But after that, you know, things started, you know, going bad. You know, all the capitalists started coming in. And so everything he said was this is going to benefit big agribusiness, the Monsantos and the Reliances of the world. And these are bogey words. Like these are like saying Gabbar Singh, Jack the Ripper, Freddy Krueger. That's exactly what these words are. You know, they don't mean anything in this context. But, you know, if you hear the word Freddy Krueger, you know, you immediately get scared, Nightmare on M Street. So he just uses these words in the same way that Arnab Goswami uses words like lobby, you know, druggy. These are just loaded words. And if you tukre gang, the moment you staple this on, you know, there's no reason why. I mean, there's, you staple it on somebody, urban Naxal, you know, that guy might not be a Naxal. That my guy might not even be urban. But if you call him urban Naxal, he's urban Naxal. So this is a rhetoric device used both by, you know, the government favoring media, as well as left-wing people like P. Sainath. Is no coherent argument. And what was the other argument? This is a fascist government. This is BJP. You know, remember demonetization, remember GST. There is something definitely evil about these guys. I can't say what it is right now, but you know what? If Jack the Ripper comes knocking on your door, do you open the door? You don't, right? So there must be something wrong. And if there was nothing wrong, why are the farmers protesting? So this is a circular logic. Of course, he will never say, and he never said over there that, you know, these are all large farmers. This does not benefit small farmers. He doesn't say that not even once. I'm pretty sure he knows that. I mean, somebody who's covered agriculture to the extent that he has knows very well that that MSP is usually not availed of, and there are statistics for that as to who benefits from MSP, that MSP principally goes to large and medium farmers. Which brings me to the conclusion of this. So what exactly is going to happen when the skies fall down? Well, honestly, nothing is going to happen. In Bihar, they had did with away with APMC for many years now. And nothing really radical has happened. But the reason why nothing radical has happened is that in order for an agribusiness model to grow, APMCs have to go away in all states, across the country. Only then does it make sense for somebody to invest in that kind of agricultural supply chain. If it's just one sporadic state here, another sporadic state here, there's really no business case at that point of time. There's no economy of scale. So in order for this business model to take off, if it at all takes off, this has to go away in all states. You have to give the right for agribusinesses to go directly to the farmer. So one hopes that this will lead to a Walmart-like food chain. You know, that is exactly how Walmart, and of course, there are many leftists in the US who say that, you know, Walmart has, you know, killed the middle class. And this I find very, very funny. So in the US, there's a group of, you know, white liberals who hate Walmart and say Walmart is the root of all evil. That previously there used to be these farmers markets where local farmers would sell their produce. I mean, they didn't have APMCs, and we would go there and buy things. And now Walmart has come and they've destroyed the local farmers market. They've destroyed the local farmers. And here's the thing, if you look at it another way, the farmers markets are still there.
But the people who shop at farmers markets are usually rich people. And the people who are really poor, they go and shop at Walmart. So it's exactly the other way around. The privilege, and this is this comes back to, you know, the classic argument that Rabindranath Tagore gave to Mahatma Gandhi, that it is your immense privilege that you believe that homespun cloth, which is made, it is so expensive, people should wear it because of patriotism, when there is like 10 times cheaper things which are coming from England, and then you pretend as if you're being pro-poor. You're absolutely not. You're being pro-rich here. The poor people want the cheap stuff. You can't take the cheap stuff away from them. So when you're saying, when you're creating this false choice that if you want to live, if you want to wear clothes, you are unpatriotic. You spin your own clothes, which is not possible for most people who work 16 hours a day, even more. Who spins cloths? People in zamindari houses who have nothing to do. If this spinning cloth in those days was like, you know, Instagram in these days. It was a social event. That was what it was. And Rabindranath Tagore came out and directly said that at that point of time, that none of this really, this is detrimental to the poor people who you claim to represent. And how did they attack Rabindranath Tagore? The exact same way they attack people now. They said, you are a rich zamindar guy. I'm a guy who's wearing no clothes. I may have only a loincloth. Who do you think understands poverty, you or me? And that's how they got rid of Rabindranath Tagore's objection, by attacking who he was, rather than attacking the substance of his argument, which was the absolutely the correct argument that he made. He foresaw, he said, and I've said this before, he decades before, he said that what Mahatma Gandhi is doing will alienate Muslims, because the Muslims in Bengal run the cloth trade, which brings in stuff from Manchester. So if you try to present this as a choice between patriotism and the ability to live their lives, obviously they will take the ability to live their lives, and then you will call them unpatriotic. And of course they will believe that the new country that will be made is going to be like this. So ultimately the economic thing will drive communism. Said this in the 1920s. That the only way you can do Swadeshi is once you have a viable economic alternative. Once you can produce cloth which is as good in terms of quality and price as the British cloth, yes, only then can you say, at that scale, only then can you say, yes, it is patriotic to buy this cloth. If you cannot say that, if you produce expensive stuff at prices that nobody can buy, nobody can even get, because, you know, they're being made by zamindars and then they wear it themselves for their own like fashion, then obviously you're not creating an alternative. This alternative does not actually exist. So we're coming back to this. So it's the exact same thing that's going on here, is that when you have big agribusiness come in, yes, big agribusiness gains. Yes, Walmart is one of the world's most profitable companies. Yes, they have billions. But it's also true that poor people shop at Walmart. That if Walmart goes away from a place in this day and age, it's the poor people who suffer the most. Because what do poor people get at a Walmart superstore? They get, over here in the US, they get everything. They go to Walmart, they buy things in bulk, in cheap, and they leave. Rich people have the option to go to this store for a specialist. You know, they go to Neiman Marcus for their clothes. They'll go to some other store for their organic groceries. They'll go to some, because they have the luxury, they have the time. Poor people who are working two jobs, they don't have the time. They only go to one place and they'll buy whatever they can and they'll come back. So this is the reason why big business ultimately helps poor people. Even, yes, they're exploitative, absolutely. But so are the middlemen. So are the middlemen who currently, I mean, these guys are no saints.
who are there in APMC, and what do you think is going to happen? The thing is that as big businesses come in, they are going to absorb some of these middlemen. They're not directly going to go and talk to farmers. So it will be a hybrid situation, except it will be outside the APMC. So some of the bigger players will be absorbed. And I can almost see a Sultan of Delhi sequel coming out here. So there'll be a lot of power. There'll be a huge power struggle. There'll be big farmers. There'll be politicians. There'll be intimidation. But now with big business, with big agribusiness, they will be fighting against very, very deep pockets. So yes, the Shiromani Akali Dal strongmen will definitely put their cherries in the sand. But then they'll be fighting with Walmart, who have, you know, a pretty big gun of their own too. So this is going to be a super battle. Now, right. Will this happen now? I don't know. I mean, if I knew this, I would be playing in the stock market and buying their stock. So states will obviously resist this, because when the APMCs die, they lose their mandises. So there's going to be a huge, huge battle now to establish superiority in this. And I don't think that this is going to happen overnight or even within a generation. And the last thing that I want to conclude with is that a few years ago, I had an interview. It was with a startup who, and as you know, that I work in security. So they were looking for somebody to, as the lead engineer for their data privacy. So what the business essentially was that they had created a service that restaurants. When they buy, and this is especially true for smaller restaurants. So bigger restaurants, like for instance, the McDonald's, and they have this very, very, I would say, well-developed models for how much raw material to procure at what point of time. So they have very, very accurate predictive models as to how much raw material to buy at what time so that there's minimal food wastage. But most companies, especially smaller mom and pop stores, they don't have that data with them to know when to buy this, what season to buy this, when is the best time to lock in a price for something else. So they don't know this. So they get screwed on the raw price they pay for raw material. And that's why they find that they can't compete with the McDonald's and the Wendy's. The reason why local mom and pop stores can't compete with these is just because the data that these guys have. They beat them on the data. They will just buy the right things at the right time. They will put in their orders at the right time, and small mom and pop stores just can't match that. So they always overpay for inventory, and they always have much higher. So he gave me data, the recruiter who talked to me. This is an alarming amount of wastage that smaller stores have that the big stores don't have. And Walmart and all these places. I mean, it's not just restaurants. It's even places like Walmart. I mean, they've made it into an art. You know, what to buy, when to buy, how to buy, who to buy, at what point of time to put in the orders. So they were basically trying to democratize the process and essentially use the power of a lot of businesses to create these data models such that you could just subscribe to this and you will be able to get, you know, this kind of machine learning based buying strategies for food. Now, these kinds of businesses don't work when you have an APMC. So this I found exciting. I mean, there were other problems with the company, but I found this at least seemed to me pretty exciting in terms of what you could do with data. And it seemed to be a very noble endeavor, I would say.
Right. I mean, Arnab, in India, if you remember, we still have massive fluctuations in the price of commodities. I mean, 1 month you would be reading in the newspaper about farmers dumping, let's say, their tomatoes or onions because they're not getting any price for it, or 1 rupee for a quintal or whatever. And then, of course, next in a few months, then you'll go to the supermarket, and right now I think on it's around 70 or 80 rupees. Yeah, so this kind of thing will help even stabilize the price and make it more. Exactly. The fluctuations should be less.
Exactly. So when you have things like contract pricing and when you have futures, you know, these things don't happen. That's why you have futures. That's the reason why. I mean, that's why in order to, for instance, run aeroplanes. I mean, they don't go to the gas pump and buy gas. Because if they did, they couldn't be profitable because gas prices fluctuate. So they lock in their rates years ago. So they basically bet on, hey, this is going to be the price. And they have data to do that. And then they put out these, hey, anybody wants me to give me this price? I'm going to buy this amount of oil at this amount on in 2022. Of course, when something like COVID happens, obviously you made your bets wrong. But the fact is this allows, I mean, this thing is done to reduce price volatility. And right now with APMC, you can't do these things. You just can't legally deal with these people. You can't deal with APMCs because APMCs is not a single, like there's a website you go to and, you know, you deal with them and they deal as, you know, an honest broker for the farmers. No, absolutely not. The APMC is a labyrinthine organization. It's not easily accessed from the outside. And the people in the APMCs are all large farmers. And so they are not honest brokers for other farmers. So they'll obviously do things which benefit them. So you cannot deal with APMC. So the only person you can deal with are the people who will directly benefit from this. No, so obviously I think that it's not going to be that, you know, a big bazaar or somebody's going to go directly to farmers, knock on their doors and say, you know, there'll obviously be some kind of aggregation business that will come up. But the fact is that this aggregation business will also give farmers a choice. If you have aggregating company A and aggregating company B and aggregating company A is screwing you, you can go to aggregating company B. But with APMC, you have a monopoly. There's only one friggin' APMC. So this is at least the way I look at it. This is what, you know, free market reform is. And I personally, you know, my ultimate judgment is I don't see anything that's wrong with the farmers' bills at all. Nothing. I think pretty much... Again, it might not lead to anything. So that's the worst thing that can happen is that the status quo goes on. But will this lead to something terrible? I don't see it. And maybe I'm not an expert, but I haven't seen anybody who said anything which is even half reasonable that this is the terrible thing that can happen. I haven't seen it anywhere.
The one criticism which I guess you pointed out is it doesn't go far enough, which again, probably the future bills...
Yes, of course it doesn't. So I think the biggest criticism of it is, it's not that it doesn't go far enough, but it still doesn't handle the problem of smaller farmers. That's the main criticism. It's not so much an act of commission more than an act of omission, I would say. Because we haven't still solved the problem of farmer suicides. We still haven't solved the problem of this immense fragmentation of land, you know, farmers. Then the next generation of farmers, they'll have four children, you know, they'll get passed on. So the amount of land just progressively keeps decreasing with each generation. So each generation gets more and more into this debt trap till you have suicides. So this problem, none of these reforms will handle that. Now you can say that maybe with these agriculture aggregation companies, maybe there'll be some kind of way that smaller farmers can get together. But that's a stretch. That's a stretch. I mean, that could happen. But okay. I mean, again, as I said, nothing terrible will happen from this. Nothing bad can happen from this. The only thing that can happen is good. And the worst that can happen is nothing. So overall, I believe that this is good policy. These are good bills. And what you see in terms of protests are being done by people who have an interest in the current system, a financial interest in the current system continuing as it is. Of course, there's something in opposition. I don't blame the opposition. I mean, there are opposition parties like Congress. I mean, their job is to basically fight tooth and nail whatever this government does. When BJP goes into the opposition, it'll do the same thing. No opposition party comes and says, even if they agree with it, that, oh, this is a lovely thing that you're doing, man. This is great. Nobody says that. So that part I get. But the visceral opposition which they have gotten from Shiromani Akali Dal is because of this. Because the Shiromani Akali Dal knows that if they don't stand on the side of their large farmers, who are firstly their biggest constituent as well as contributors, then they might as well kiss their chances of ever getting back into power in the state goodbye. So they did what they had to do. And I think that the NDA government, of course, the BJP government also knew they were going to do this.
So I think the BJP government is confident enough that politically they're confident that in any case, the SAD government isn't coming back in a while. And so it's fine. This is a loss that we are willing to take. Again, will this benefit big business? Yeah, I guess so. But the difference between me and P. Sainath is I don't significantly consider big business to be an unmitigated evil. I am well aware that yes, they are evil like any other. They're not unmitigated evil. They can be evil. Anything in the world. I mean, when you have a profit motive, there is, of course, that, you know, the profit motive comes with that, but it also comes with benefits. Middlemen don't come with any benefits. Middlemen don't provide any value. Big players provide some value. They provide the customer-facing value. They provide customer service. They have data. They invest in investigating the data. They invest in optimization. Middlemen don't do anything. The middlemen at the mandi, they don't do anything. That's really the whole Urta Punjab problem and everything. You have guaranteed income coming from the large farmers where they don't have to do anything. It's just a boring life. What are you going to do except shoot up? That's really the problem in a place like Punjab. That's really how the problem started. Because there's really nothing to do. It's all guaranteed. It's all guaranteed income. It's not taxed. This is a great business to be in. And again, I'm happy that the farms, that ultimately some elected government has had some, let's say, can we use the word balls here? to go after the very entrenched, large and rich farmer lobby. Make sure you remember those adjectives. Large and rich farmer lobby. These are not the small farmers. Small farmers are going to be untouched largely by this. That's the problem, largely untouched. I wish there was some benefit from them, for them. That's the act of omission, I would say. That's the only downside of this. But again, as I said, what's the other alternative? Not passing this doesn't help anybody except the middlemen and the large farmers. And it skews the market because of the selective nature of who gets MSP and who doesn't. The state bonuses, which skew the markets, leading to huge quantities of certain crops being produced, even when there is no conceivable demand for it. This is an absolute abomination in terms of what a market economy should be. An absolute abomination. It is a throwback to the worst of socialist red tapism. And I'm glad that a government is finally taking at least some preliminary steps to dismantle this system. That's the podcast for today.
All right. So just remember to leave a rating and a review for the podcast on your podcast app, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Google or whatever. Hopefully a good review and rating. And until next time, take care. Bye-bye.